The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, episode 518 for Sunday, September 7th, 2014. And welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab. You know the show. It's the one where you try to learn stuff. We try to learn stuff. You ask questions. We try to give answers. We share your answers. We share your tips. We share all kinds of stuff. We have a blast here while we learn. And that is the goal. This episode is sponsored by Harry's at Harry's.com. Harry's.com with coupon code MGG gets you $5 off your first order with them, which is really awesome. And we'll talk more about that during the show. Also, this episode is sponsored by Lynda at lynda.com/MGG. And visiting that link gets you 7 days of free tutorials, videos, all of that great stuff that Lynda is known for and does so well. And we'll talk more about that during the show here in Durham, New Hampshire. I'm Dave Hamilton.
Here in Fairfield, Connecticut, John F. Brown.
You had to check your surroundings there, John?
Yeah. It was a pretty wild party last night.
Yeah.
Yeah, that gets.
Make sure you are where you think you are, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, you know that. You know when you wake up and you're not quite sure where you are.
Yeah, well, listen.
Ever have that?
Dude, every day what I do, and it's great now because I always have my iPhone with me and with this case, which I like, the spec card, I think it's the card folio case. It's the one that, we'll put a link in the show notes now that I mentioned it, but it's the one that I can fit three credit card size things into. Mm-hmm. And so I have my license in there as well as two credit cards, which is great. Because if I leave the house, I have my phone and I definitely have my license in some way to pay people for mm-hmm. things. But I have that with me. And when I get up in the morning, I go straight to the bathroom. I look in the mirror. I hold up my license. I make sure it's me. Right. And then my phone has the date on it. And I compare the date on my phone to the date on my driver's license. And I make sure it's not my birthday. That's how I wake up every morning. Isn't that what everybody does?
Well, if you want to make sure you're grounded, then yeah, no, that's a good strategy.
That's it. I know who I am. I know my name and I know if it's my birthday. What three things do you need to know to start? I mean, is there anything better on the list to start the day? I don't think so. I think that's the way you start the day.
All right.
Yep. But today, John, at least to start the day, it's not about you. It's not about me. It's not even about all of our listeners. It's all about the Larrys. We've got three, not one, not two, but three. We probably could do a whole show of Larrys. I'm looking at the question queue. And if we go back, if we're willing to go back about a year, we could probably fill up the show with questions from people named Larry that we have yet to answer on the show. But we're not going to do that. I don't think we're going to do that, but who knows? We get three deep into this, man. We might get on a tear. So,
I'm going to tear it up, yo.
Yeah.
All right.
So you want to start with, you know what, John, why don't we start with Larry?
I'm starting with Larry.
Okay. Yeah. Start with Larry.
Larry writes, hi.
Hi.
Just hi.
That's an interesting question.
I do not want to install the current version of Pages. The current version lacks the functionality I need from the previous version. And additionally, if used, will update my file formats and make my working files inaccessible to the old version. I cannot find a way to turn these notifications off. I'm very concerned I will accidentally update and then have to waste time fixing a problem that doesn't exist. I've tried Googling for an answer and I've failed to find something that works. How do I remove the current version of Pages from my list of updates and turn these notifications off?
That's a valid question. It's
not obvious.
No, we should answer this question because it's important to answer how to do this. But with Pages specifically, there is actually an asterisk with a caveat. But I think let's answer the question first. Then we'll address that. Yeah, then we'll address the caveat.
Oddly enough, the answer to this problem is in a handy dandy little article called Mac App Store Hiding and Underhiding Purchases. And if you look, so it gives instructions for various versions of OS X, and starting with Mountain Lion, it appears. It gives you a whole bunch of steps here on how to, you know, hide something. And then it says, note, you will no longer receive update notifications for items after they've been hidden from your purchases page. So that's certainly, in my book, non-intuitive way of turning off alerts. I mean, why don't you just have a choice somewhere saying turn off update notifications?
So,
and of course, if you hide something, so you won't see it anymore. And then they also have instructions on how to yes, you can unhide something, but hiding a program from a purchase, even if it's a free one, because I had this problem too. I did want to upgrade to the later versions. So no, I did not have this problem.
Okay.
But I've had it for other things where, yeah, just don't want to hear about it.
Yeah. Well, So what say exactly again, what the process is for hiding these? You hit the little X right next to where it says that it's installed. Is that right?
In some versions you'll see a little X.
Okay.
Or you right click and then you will see a hide purchase item.
Got it.
And you say hide.
Got it.
It depends. So it outlines how to do this in multiple different versions.
Okay. Okay.
It's different.
Of course it's different. Right. 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 That's interesting. Very interesting. All right. So yeah, but with pages, as we mentioned, there is this caveat because everything Larry says is absolutely correct. If he updates and uses the new version of Pages, it's going to update his file formats to the new unified file format. It's actually not a new file format. It's the file format that you've had on iPad for a long time. And now it is backed over to the Mac. And yes, that creates some wonkiness, especially if you're in a mixed platform environment and all that stuff. So Apple knew this, and what they do is if you update anything in iWork, Pages, Numbers, or Keynote, which all will suffer or be affected, I should say, by this issue where you got a new format and a new everything, the App Store will not replace the old version. It will take the old version and move it into an iWork, I believe it's iWork 09 folder, right? And they live there forever until you delete them. So yes, you will have the new version on there. And yes, you potentially run the risk of launching the new version unintentionally, right? And having to deal with that. But it will not delete the old version because they knew that it's really a separate program. It's not... it's a port to the Mac of the iPad version. It's not an update to the Mac version. So they knew this and made a special exception for it. So you're probably safe letting the update happen and having the new one around too, in case you get one of these new files, and then you can do whatever you want. So there you go. We good with Larry, John?
Yeah.
All right, let's
now
move.
We're done with Larry. I'm going to move on to Larry.
Brilliant.
Not the other Larry.
Though, no,
because it's too soon for that.
It's too soon for that. That's right. That's ridiculous, John, to go to Larry. We've got to deal with Larry first.
So Larry writes and says, I just got this email from my cable provider, and I will condense what's in it. It's an email from Cox saying you want a DOCSIS 3. You should get a DOCSIS 3 cable modem because it's great. It's basically what they said. Then they say, click here to buy or rent a new modem. So that's the ulterior motive, I think.
Yeah.
But he says, you know, I'm happy with my current speeds. Now we can skip. But he says he's getting a speed test. He's getting a 32 millisecond ping. He's getting 33 megabits per second down, which is pretty good for a basic cable connection, and 7 up. Will there be a difference? I'd say almost certainly yes.
Yeah.
Almost certainly. Well, just because I relayed my tale of woe where I had this DOCSIS 2 Scientific Atlanta modem and I was getting terrible speeds and I thought it was my cable. I shortened the cable length so there wasn't as much loss and stuff. And just things still weren't going that great. So in my case, I swapped it out with my provider. Now my case, it's supposed, well, it's, they don't charge extra. It's free as long as you're a subscriber versus a, though I suppose you could buy your own if you wanted to.
Oh, so you don't, they don't break out a rental fee that you could avoid if you chose to buy your own cable modem. Is that right?
Correct.
Oh, that's interesting. Huh?
Yet they supply it.
Right. Right. Of course. Of course. Yeah, you know.
So for me, there's no good reason, because the one I got is I'll admit the prior DOCSIS 2 one was, I mean, you know, was it inexpensive? I'll venture to say cheap.
Okay. Yeah. Right. Right.
Where's this one I got now? This Aeris one that they gave me, which is also actually, if I ever want to get voice, which they keep reminding me about getting every week, I think.
Yeah.
This is actually a DOCSIS 3 and a voice or a VoIP modem if I chose to have that feature. So,
okay.
So I would say maybe, you know, if you're happy with your speeds now, that's great, but it could make your speeds better. I certainly saw it in my case because you now have multiple channels, I guess, or data streams. And you'll see this on the Diag page if they let you get to it. Like, I think you and I both have, Dave, I think 8 downstream channels and 4 upstream. I think that's usually how they set up most people.
Is that how DOCSIS 3 is? I can check. Because I choose to lease my modem from Comcast. I have the option because if I did not lease a modem from Comcast, I would, I could buy one and avoid. It's about $5 a month. It might be 6, but it's right in there. But yeah, I've got 8 downstream and 4 upstream channels. I just checked my modem by going to the standard 192.168.100.1 address. So the reason, I have a couple of reasons that I choose to rent mine. Number one is that the biggest one is that it's on Comcast to make sure that I have a working cable modem. And I feel like that's worth its weight in gold at those moments that I have an issue. Because there's none of the finger pointing of, oh, well, you're using your own cable modem, so it's hard for us to diagnose and yada, yada, yada. So that's the biggest reason. The number two is I actually have 2 cable modems from Comcast. I pay them to rent one, but they've given me 2. We have VoIP service, John, and we also have obviously internet service. And at least as of about a year ago, maybe a year and a half ago, so this may have changed since when I moved up to the DOCSIS 3, I did what you did. I just went down to the store and had them give me one. But the woman there said, hey, here's the deal. They don't carry the VoIP modems on the trucks. So I recommend you have 2 modems, one that you just use for your VoIP connection, and then the other that you use just for your internet connection, because that way, if your internet connection goes down, there is a truck in your area during the day that has a replacement for you. Whereas if you need to replace the VoIP part, we've got to order that, or you've got to come in here and that sort of thing. So I have 2 modems, which is sort of weird. And I should check on that and see if that's still the case. But so far, so good. Yeah.
And they got this guy driving around with modems just in case you need one. That's all he does all day.
Well, sometimes that's what it takes to solve the problem, right?
That's customer service.
Yeah. You know, Comcast gets a lot of flack, and I'm sure some of it is well deserved. But my personal experience with their customer service time and time again has been fantastic. I always get I am always able to get someone that knows what they're doing and can help me. The quickest path I find to that is to use their online chat. Now, obviously, if your internet connection is down, that's not going to work out. But using their online chat, it always seems to get me to someone that knows what they're doing and is always able to solve my problem. It's been great. And the texts that come out really know what they're doing. It's good stuff. Like I said, I know they get a lot of flack, and probably deservedly so, but that is not a widespread thing that I have found, at least not in this area. But we're in Boston, or we're not in Boston. We're in the Boston serviced Comcast area, which is one of their largest, and so maybe that's why. Did we answer Larry's question, or did I tangentialize that right into oblivion?
I think the answer is at some point you're going to want to, and I don't see any downside. I think we've gotten one or two reports of people who were clearly insane saying that when they got a DOCSIS 3 cable modem, their performance got worse.
Yeah, that's either insanity or just bad hardware.
Yeah, and I think it's bad hardware.
Right.
I see most of these guys. I mean, you know, they had one time when I went to Cablevision, you know, they hide most of this now. But I remember when, you know, there was a big upgrade from the last, you know, big purge of the prior model. And they just took your cable modem and threw it in this big, what looked to be a garbage bin. Because
right.
I think they were going to throw them away.
Right.
Even some of, you know, even the older equipment, they're like, well, technically you have to give it back to us. I'm like, but you're just going to throw it in the trash.
You're right? Going
to
throw it away. Like,
yeah.
That's right. That's right.
Sad.
All right, John. So it is time to talk about Larry. But first, I want to talk about Harry's. Harry's is our first sponsor at harrys.com/MGG. These folks at Harry's, they figured out that going to the pharmacy and buying crummy, crappy razors and spending, you know, $15 to $30 on everything that you were going to need to buy anyway was a losing battle and a bad experience. And so they created Harry's.com to completely turn that experience upside down. So now, instead of going to the pharmacy and spending $15 to $30 on crappy razors and shave gear and all of that stuff, you go online to Harry's.com and you spend $15 to maybe $30, but you can actually start really well at the $15 level. And you get really good stuff. It's a 5-bladed razor that you get, and the handle is really, really nice. I've seen both the Truman and the Winston set. The Truman set's available for $15. The Winston set's available for $25. They both come with a tube of shave cream, and this shave cream, I feel it's so decadent. I feel like it's like, it's not it, obviously, but it's like silk. When I put this stuff in my hands, it's so good, and it doesn't over lather, but it's perfect. I love this stuff. If I didn't love it so much to shave with, I would just like hold it in my hands all the time because it just feels so good. It's so good. It's such a treat. I don't know. I think that's crazy, but I like it. It's so nice. And, so they both come with the shave cream. They both come with, I believe 3 heads. And then, with razors in the heads, the 5-bladed thing, and then the handle. And it's so, this stuff has actually, you know, when they first became sponsors, John and I both got kits, but prior to that, I mostly shaved with an electric, and this has converted me to like 90% of the time I now shave with the blade, because it's a much better shave. It and the stuff is so good. And the blades last a while for me. It's not like I have to replace them constantly. And that's kind of the best part. Is you go online and you buy your first kit from them. And again, using coupon code MGG, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, gets you $5 off. So this Truman set, which is the handle, the full tube of shave cream and the 3 heads, is $15, but you get it for 10. It's $10 to try this out. And I was hooked. I mean, they sent us each a kit, and I'm hooked. So, you know, you get a nice close shave. It doesn't really take me any longer to shave with this than it does with the electric. And it's a much nicer shave. The whole kit is actually very well done. It feels, it's got that Apple feel to it. When you open up the box, you know, you've got like a little card in there, and it tells you, it's sort of funny and kitschy, and walks you through the process of shaving, and it has some little jokey stuff in there. It's fun. I'm not going to ruin all the surprises for you, but it's well worth checking out, especially when you can start for just $10. But then if you do get hooked like I have, then you can sign up. You can order refills one off, no problem at all. You can order blades or shave cream or you know, the handles or whatever you want. But they also have shave plans if you want to do that. And they've actually got three different shave plans that they've set up. One for the everyday shaver, where you get stuff every 2 months. You know, that's the most frequent they expect you that you would need to get refills from them. The occasional shaver, where you get a shipment every 3 months, or the infrequent shaver, where you get a shipment every 5 months. I probably fall into that realm because I get to do this for a living and I don't have to shave. It's either this or I'm out playing gigs. And so either one works okay. But if that's either not, if that's not, if one of those three isn't exactly right for you, you build your own plan. You pick how much you want and you know, how many blades, how many creams, and the frequency that you want the stuff sent, and you sign up, or you just order when you know you need stuff. If you don't mind doing that, there is no, you don't get locked in unless you choose to sign up for a subscription, which of course you can cancel. So, it's great, great stuff. And, you know, it's geared towards guys, but there's nothing in the rules that says, and in fact, we've had several female listeners write in and say that they have bought these not only for the men in their lives, but also for themselves and love it. So check it out. Harrys.com. The coupon code is MGG, and that gets you $5 off your first order with them. And it is delivered for free. So you start with it literally costs you $10 to try this out. So just go right now, harrys.com, place your order, put your address in, put your credit card in, and they aren't going to sign you up for subscription. You know, just you just the one order, $10, use the coupon code MGG, and that'll make sure it's 10 and not 15. Not that 15 is expensive, but you know, hey, $5 is $5. So check them out and thank them for us. harrys.com/MGG. All right, John, are you all well shorn from your hairy stuff? Can we now move on to Larry?
Yeah, I'm often well shorn.
Right.
Sometimes I let it all go just because, you know, like you said, you can.
Because you can. Right. Yeah.
But when I want to look civilized, then you have to interact with society. And yeah, I'll
you know, the thing, Harry's. my wife, I mean, I can notice the difference that these Harry's blades give me, but my wife definitely notices the difference and she loves it. So that was part of the impetus for me to switch to shaving with it. But it's a nice process to just take a moment for yourself and shave. It's kind of a decadent little treat that doesn't really take that long. So, all right, moving on to Larry, because that is how we roll. Larry writes, I'd written to you guys before about some USB idiosyncrasies I was having. In particular, I could find a hub to be able to power all my devices and charge my iPhone and iPad. You've given me the whole litany explaining amps and watts, and things have gone swimmingly for a while. But now, suddenly, drives are not showing up. My iPhone will not mount. I had what I thought was an awesome 7-port Aluratech hub. It seemed to provide enough power to everything, and all was cool for a while. Then, suddenly last week, things started not showing up on my desktop. Last night, I spent about an hour and a half rearranging everything on my system. I did find one drive that was connected to the hub that needed to be repaired, so I did that. But it seems to be okay with the two drives connected, but when I connect a third, all goes haywire. As well, if I connect my iPhone to the hub now, it's a Monty Python-esque Thin Mint. As has the hub gone bad? Is the port bad on my computer? I'm completely at a loss. So this is a good question, because I've seen this happen. So let's take a step back here and forgetting for a second about what used to work, though that's obviously important. But let's just diagnose what you're seeing right now. And what you're seeing now, you plug in two drives, it's okay. You plug in a third, it's not. That tells me that you're not getting enough power. The hub doesn't have enough power. The USB bus doesn't have enough power to power three drives. It can do two, but it can't do three. So now, right? So that, I mean, that, and I think we'd all agree, John, that that's probably the correct diagnosis. We're not to the why yet, but would you agree with that?
So far, yes, and I'm trying to determine whether this is powered or not powered.
It's a powered hub. It was, yeah. But yeah, so
that's what I thought.
Right.
That's kind of unusual, but it happens.
But it happens. But here's the thing that I've seen, and I'm sure you've seen, John, if you have a powered hub and you happen to choose not to plug it in, it still works. It just takes whatever power it gets from the computer and passes it along to the bus, which is usually a lot less than it would have if of course you had plugged in your own power supply to the thing. So, what it sounds like has happened here is that either the power supply for the hub has gone bad and it's just passing computer power through, or something about the hub has gone bad. And even though the power supply is giving the hub power, the hub is not passing that through, right? I mean, at some point in the chain, the power is not getting through to the USB bus. And it certainly, certainly seems like that's what's going on here. So my advice is you check the power supply. It could be, you know, if you've got a, I was going to say an ohm meter, but that's wrong. If you got a volt meter, which could also be an ohm meter with the switch at a different spot, go ahead and check the, you know, the power coming off the tip of the power supply. See if you're getting power there. If you're not, and you happen to be one of those people like me that saves old power supplies from other things, despite the fact that your family yells at you about it, you might be able to dig into that box and find a compatible one and plug it in and be good to go. Just make sure it's spitting out the same, not only the same voltage, but also that the tip and the ring are doing the same thing. So you want positive and negative to match what you're replacing it from. But if you've got that, great. And if not, just go buy a new hub, a new powered hub. And as it turns out, we had given this advice to Larry, and he did go buy a new powered hub. He went and bought an Anker hub, A-N-K-E-R. We here have had great luck, or I've had, I don't know if you've got any Anker stuff, John, but we've had some great luck here in the T-Mo Towers East with the Anker stuff. It's at ianker.com, but they sell them on Amazon and all that stuff. They're they understand. They really understand USB power. That's they make good products, but it comes from an understanding of USB power. They're the ones that figured out how to do. They have, what do they call it, Smart IQ, where you can have a charger brick that will send 2.1 amps to either iOS or Android devices, which is actually kind of a trick, because they both negotiate different ways. And so they've got some smarts in there that will negotiate the right way and allow all these things to work. So these guys understand USB power, and I feel pretty comfortable recommending them for this solution. And that's what Larry ordered. So hopefully we'll hear from
all right.
him. Yeah.
Because actually the one he was using, as a matter of fact, is not powered.
Oh, interesting.
I looked it up. It says plug and play. Well, you got to read this, right? It says, hey, plug and play. Just plug it in and start using it. By the way, it doesn't have an external power adapter. It says no external power adapter needed, which may sound like a good thing, but that means that it's limited to providing the amount of power that's provided by the USB port that it's plugged into, which may not... a powered hub has the potential to offer more.
But John, I'm looking at this. It may say no power needed, but I'm looking at a picture of this Aluratech 7-port hub, and there are two ports on the front, two USB ports on the front, five USB ports on the back, a USB-B port to link to the computer on the back, and a DC power in port. So while it may not need external power, it certainly will take external power.
Interesting. Yeah. They don't word that very well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Of course, the answer is that, yeah, if it's not plugged in, then plug it in, because sometimes, right. Yeah, you may be reaching the limit of, look at that. Package contents power adapter.
There you go.
So while I tout its ability to run without a power adapter, which I think nearly almost anyone should be
sure.
able to.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, so the thing that gets expensive while we're talking about this with USB hubs is the USB 3 ports, right? And certainly if you've got a USB 3 Mac, you probably want some level of USB 3 ports, especially if you've got to give one up to plug into your hub. You want the hub to have at least one to pass that through and have full speed. But some hubs do come with both USB 2 and USB 3 ports. And that can be a really handy and economical way to expand your system, because there's a lot of things, your iPhone, you know, lots of older devices, your printer, that sort of thing, do not need nor can use USB 3. But you might have a hard drive or two that does use USB 3 and you want to be able to plug those into your hub. So so you could certainly can go get a hub that has, you know, all USB 3 ports. But you're going to pay a little more for that, because each of those USB 3 ports, I don't know if it's a licensing thing or just simply the cost of technology. But you can, I've seen some things that, you know, the 7-port hub that has 3 USB 3 and 4 USB 2 ports. And it's typically quite a bit cheaper than a 7-port hub with all USB 3 ports. So it's worth checking out and, you know, kind of bearing that in mind as you make your purchase decision as you expand. Yeah, good stuff, John.
Yeah, actually, I found one here that I've used in the past on a work machine. Satechi 12-port USB hub. I remember I got this because one of our friends reviewed it. But also it has cool blue LED lights for the ports, so you can see them. And
you know,
but it also plugs in. But I actually did have a need to test 12 USB devices at once, and it handled it swimmingly.
Oh, that's sweet. That's sweet. You know, I was looking up these Anker hubs on Amazon. You can get the 7-port Anker hub, which I believe is all USB 3. So 7 USB 3 ports for $30. So maybe you don't need to worry at that price. Maybe you don't need to worry about going overly cheap. That's a heck of a deal. And that's on Amazon there. So. There you go. There you go. So what do we have next here, John?
Ted.
Oh, yeah, Ted. Oh, yeah. This is so this falls into the audio realm. So I think it's got to be me. Yeah. All right. So Ted says, I have a really odd problem. We love those. No less than 5 Apple geniuses not only could not figure out the problem, none of them had ever even heard of it. I recently replaced my old 2009 MacBook Pro with a 2013 MacBook Pro. I do audio recording from a small makeshift studio on my MacBook Pro using a powered USB hub into a USB port. The hub has a MIDI keyboard and 3 mics plugged into it. I use the Audio MIDI utility to set up an aggregate device and record into Logic Express. The old Mac worked great, but my grandson kicked it and broke the headphone jack, thus a new computer. However, the new Mac... on the new Mac, aggregate devices do not work. Each individual mic works, but not the aggregate. 5 geniuses had never heard of an aggregate device, and none of them could figure out what the problem was. Being only 2 months old, I asked for a new MacBook Pro, but they refused. It's currently in the shop getting a new logic board. Can you tell me how the aggregate actually works and what hardware controls it? And if possible, why the individual inputs would work, but not as an aggregate? Lots of technicians scratching their heads. Okay, so... for those of you that don't know what we're talking about, this is an esoteric, well, not esoteric, it's a hidden, somewhat hidden, often unused, often unseen by most users, feature of the way the Mac works. When you are going to record in an audio application like GarageBand or Logic, typically what you get to do is pick one audio interface to use. Now that can be the built-in audio on your Mac, which has typically two channels in and two channels out, right? Stereo in and stereo out, but you don't have to use them in stereo. You can, if you get the right adapters, you can send different things in and have two channels being recorded and two channels playing out. Or you could get, say, you know, I have this, this Tascam US1641 that has, 16 channels in and 4 channels out. And when I choose that, then inside Logic or GarageBand, instead of seeing 2 channels and being able to pick 1 or 2 on the input, I can pick 1 through 16 on the input. And that's really handy if you want to do some recording like we do for the podcast here. I like to have, you know, we have John and me and Pete when he's here. He screwed up the schedule today. He's in the chat room. I'll say hi to everybody in the chat room, including Pilot Pete at MacGeekGab.com/stream. But I have Pete, and then our audio comments all come in. And so I have four channels actually, going out and in. It's a whole big convoluted setup that we won't confuse this question with, but that's how that works. Now, where that gets frustrating is if you buy, say, three or four USB mics and you plug them into your Mac, like Ted is doing, each of them is a separate audio device. And so you can't go, if you, you can choose each one of them in GarageBand or Logic, but then it won't, your Mac won't see the others. And that's frustrating. And you want to record all of them at once. And so the solution is something Apple has built for us. You launch an app that's in your applications utilities folder called Audio MIDI Setup. At the bottom, you'll see a little plus sign. What the app does is it shows you all the audio devices that are connected, and you can set different things like the sample rate and the clock source and, you know, where things route and all of that. And it's great. But at the bottom, you have a little plus sign. And when you hit that, you get to create what's called an aggregate audio device. And that is what it sounds like. You, it's a virtual audio device that your Mac, that you as the user get to assign actual audio devices to. So in my case, you know, I have this Tascam and my built-in audio. I could choose to create an aggregate device that now lets me use the 16 inputs on the Tascam and the two inputs on my built-in audio simultaneously, and Logic will see it as one device and therefore can address it all at once. So that's what an aggregate audio device does. Ted is using it for exactly the right purpose. The question is, why doesn't it work on his new computer? And the answer is it should just work, but there are a couple of things that can confuse this process. And this gets into core audio and how things have been abstracted a little bit in more recent OSs. And those two things that typically cause trouble are the clock source and the sample rate. The clock source is you get to decide what hardware device is being used to sync everything to in terms of time, right? And when audio comes in, it's got to lock into a time source. My experience, and I've mentioned this on the show as we've sort of gone through our audio mavericks trials and tribulations, John, is that using the built-in microphone as the clock source, even for an external audio device, often turns out to be the smartest move, because the Mac works better with its own clock source in most situations than it does with an external. But the trick is you just try it and find out what works best for your situation. For us, the built-in clock source is 100% the right decision, but we have our setup, your setup. It might be that you want to use the external device as a clock source. So that's number one. Number two is the sample rate. Starting with 44,100 hertz or 44.1 kilohertz is a pretty standard thing. And whatever you choose for your clock source, you want to make sure, A, it's the same on all of your devices, especially if you're doing an aggregate device, and B, that it is something that's supported by all of your devices, because not every device is going to support every clock source. So you go to each individual device, set it to, you know, whatever you want. 44.1 is a good starting point. And then also set your aggregate device to that. Hopefully that does it. I happen to know that this actually didn't help with Ted, and he's kind of dealing down a different path here. But in a general sense, that's what aggregate audio devices are, and that's what they do. Can be really helpful. You know, I know a lot of you out there are podcasters or doing some kind of audio recording, and certainly the easiest mics to work with are the mics that I call all-in-ones. They are USB mics. And if you want to record more than one of them simultaneously, aggregate audio devices are your friend. So there we go. Did I do well on that, John?
I get it.
Well, that there we go, right? That's the goal. Hopefully everybody gets it.
I need multiple USB mics in order to try this out.
Right. You would need, do you have a USB mic, John?
I don't think so.
Do you have a Bluetooth microphone?
Yeah, I think I got one of those.
So with a Bluetooth microphone or a single USB mic, you now have two separate audio input devices on your Mac. You have the built-in input and either the USB or the Bluetooth. And so you could aggregate the two of them together. Okay. Right? You know, and if that's kind of interesting. You know, you can get really creative because you can create a total Frankenstein of audio inputs. You know, you could have one person on a wireless Bluetooth and one person on a wired thing, you know, plugged into USB, and another person with a microphone, or, you know, plugged into the line in on your Mac, and you can pull them all in and do it all. Now, you know, each one is going to have its own characteristics, but that's how microphones work. So makes it fun. I don't know. I like that stuff. And if you really like that stuff, tell me, and eventually maybe we'll talk about, we'll do another show explaining our crazy setup here, because if that was interesting to you, then the show explaining the way we do our audio here probably would be extremely interesting to you. If it's not interesting to you, then you probably get bored hearing about that times like seven, because that's how our setup works here, but it's usually pretty awesome. All right, so what are we moving on to here, John? We're moving on to Adam. Is it time?
Sounds complicated.
It does. I know. This is going to make us scratch our heads. It's too early in the morning to scratch our heads, John, but we must press on. He says, I've got a puzzler and none of my Google Foo skills have been able to turn up a solution for this. 35 Mac Office, mixed 10.8 and 10.9, so Mountain Lion and Mavericks environment, eventually all going to Mavericks. Each person at my office has an Apple ID for the purpose of sharing calendars, amongst other things. We can all subscribe to and view each other's calendars without a problem. The issue manifests like this. Say, Alan, Bob, Carl, David, and Ed are all subscribed to each other's calendars, view only. The settings in calendar are set to refresh every 15 minutes, remove attachments and alerts, and most pertinent, ignore alerts. Alan schedules a meeting and then invites Bob, Carl, and David. One or more of the invitees will get a calendar notification for every person invited. David will get notices that, when he clicks on them, shows that they belong to Bob and Carl's calendars. Not being an admin on those calendars, he can't accept or reject them, so they just come back at a later time after being dismissed. Ed also might get notices, and he's not even invited to the meeting. He might just get alerts for upcoming items on the others' schedules. This happens on any device they view calendars on, Mac or iOS. It does not happen for every calendar they are subscribed to. Personally, I get notices for only two or three of the 40 calendars I'm subscribed to. My bosses seem to get more, and since they have more meetings scheduled than me, they get a lot of notices. Hence, my search for an answer to this problem. Toggling ignore alerts does not help. Deleting and resubscribing to the calendar does not help. I've thought of trying to get new subscription links created somehow, but that's impractical to implement. I'm running the Yosemite beta on a spare laptop, and when given the same settings, I get no notices intended for other users. So while Apple is apparently aware of this issue and knows how to fix it, I need something I can do now, not later this year. So, yeah, the ignore alerts feature is, in my experience, only there to ignore the reminders that you put in your calendar. When you set up a meeting, you can say, alert me an hour before this meeting so I know to get ready for it, or 5 minutes before this meeting so I know to, you know, wrap up what I'm doing and make the phone call, or whatever it is, right? You can set those alerts in iCal. You can set them in every calendar program that exists. Those are the alerts that when you subscribe to someone else's calendar, like if you were to subscribe to the Mac Geek Gab calendar, you may choose, and you can do that at MacGeekGab.com/calendar. And that way, you know, when we're recording the live show and if we're at any events or anything like that. And you can choose to ignore alerts there. However, that doesn't, in my experience, I've been like Adam. I don't see that you still get the notifications for invitations and that sort of thing. And maybe Apple has fixed that in Yosemite, because you shouldn't be getting those. But the way you're using iCal, the way you're using iCloud Calendar is not at all what it was intended to be used for, Adam. It's not meant to be a work group calendar solution. You've kind of cobbled together a semi workable scenario, and kudos to you for doing that. We love those kind of workarounds here, but it is fraught with opportunities for disaster. First of all, everybody has to manually subscribe to each other's calendars. And if something changes on one computer, and Bob deletes his work calendar and creates a new one, everybody then has to go resubscribe to that, and he has to reshare it. And it's this, you know, many to many relationship that requires a lot of brain power at the very least to manage and troubleshoot. And here we are. My advice would be as great. And I really do believe that iCloud Calendar is a fantastic calendar solution. I use it for a lot of what I do. I know you use it, John, and we use it together for our Mac Geek Gab calendar, but it is not meant to be a work group calendar solution. There is a way of doing that if you set up an OS X server, which again can be done for, what is it, $20 to upgrade from OS X to OS X server, right? So cheap, you got a dedicated Mac to it. Maybe you might already have a Mac that can run this stuff in the background. It's not super intensive, and you can run a CalDAV server on that and do more work groupy kind of stuff. Or you could sign up for an exchange server account, either again self-hosted or managed in the cloud elsewhere. And that's going to do a lot more of what you actually want. This is truly built to be an enterprise work group calendar solution that iCloud Calendar is not meant to be. So you want a true CalDAV or exchange server of your own. And I think you clearly have the chops to manage it. And you can probably convince your bosses. If you have an extra Mac, it is literally a $20 expense to upgrade to OS X server. If you don't have a spare Mac, well, then you either get to choose to buy one and manage it yourself, or the monthly fee for each account on a hosted exchange or other type of server. That's my advice. John, you've dealt with this too, right, John?
The only thing that I noticed is that in the calendar app, if you go to preferences, alerts, there is a checkbox, which I don't have checked probably because I never needed to, but the title of it is turn off shared calendar messages in notifications center. That may cut down on the chatter a bit.
Yeah.
There's actually a couple of settings in there, as well as the default action for events, all day events and birthdays. So
yep.
I may want to fiddle with that a little bit, but I'm with you, Dave. I mean, the server-based solution like Maverick Server, I'm looking at it right now and it's off because, yeah, I don't host the calendar server.
Sure.
I should.
Maybe we should. Yeah. As I was answering this question, I'm thinking, gosh, you know, I've cobbled together a solution here for us, right? You and I have a shared calendar that we do Mac Geek Gab stuff, but I also have Lisa subscribed to that in a read-only fashion, like any of our listeners could be, so that she knows when I'm recording the show. And then I have a calendar. It used to just be for my gigs, but now that my son, once my son started playing sports and my daughter started doing dance recitals and then playing gigs with the drums, we just made it a Hamilton Games and Gigs calendar, right? And so we all publish our gigs and games to that. And that way, A, we all see each other's, but we also, like my dad and my brother, can subscribe to that calendar and see when there's stuff going on. So so we've cobbled it together and it does work. But I wonder if running a CalDAV server, and listen, I could run one in Mavericks. I could run one on my Synology, right? You know, that's got the ability. Sure. And it's running all the time, which is kind of why I default to that. It's like, can I use this device? Can I use my Synology for that? Because it is running all the time and it's kind of built to be my default server for services like that. Maybe I should. I definitely should. Why haven't I? This is crazy, John. I'm going to do that. You know what? I'm going to do it in my free time this week, but you know, between flying to and from Cupertino for the Apple event and all that good stuff. I'm sure I'll have plenty of time this week to handle that, but we should. It'd be fun. And if we both set them up, I wonder if we can sync between them. I haven't done enough with that to know. I don't know.
Indeed.
Yeah. Fun. All right. What are we doing? Are we going to, is it Louis? You know what? Let's, I want to talk about our second sponsor, John, which, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, is Lynda, LYNDA.com/MGG. This is, I love when our sponsors fit the needs of our users. In fact, we typically, with very, very few exceptions, we won't take a sponsor that we don't feel at least fits the same metric that we use for any topic in the show, which I call our 20% rule. Something has to apply to 20% or more of the people in the show for us to include it. That involves questions as well as sponsors. But Linda is one of those that I feel like is 100% match. And it's because they offer something that is exactly parallel to what we do here at the show. You know, you listen to the show, well, for our witty banter and insight into whatever it is we believe. But I think that, you know, the obviously the meat of what we offer here is technical advice, answering questions and helping you learn more about the stuff that you use every day. And that's what Linda does too. They produce these killer videos, right? I mean, these are so well done. They're pros. They have pros doing the talent, if you will, right? People that really know what they're doing, and people that you know, Chris Breen does a bunch of videos. These are folks you know creating videos, but they're produced by excellent pro producers at Linda, and you can learn about all kinds of different things there. Certainly tech stuff. And if all you used your Linda subscription for was learning tech stuff, you could just constantly absorb new information and never run dry. You know, they keep creating new courses, but it's not just tech stuff. You know, I mean, certainly they do. You want to learn about Adobe Creative Cloud? Done. You want to learn about Microsoft Office? Done. Final Cut Pro, QuickBooks, all of it, right? OS 10, they always do stuff. I'm sure with iOS 8 and eventually Yosemite coming, that you're going to be able to really do a deep dive and just say, here I go. I want to, you know, dig in and learn about, iOS 8. And you're just going to all at once be able to absorb all this information that's taught by somebody that actually knows what they're talking about and produced in a really, really well done way. But they've also got, you know, business courses. If you want to learn about accounting, you can do that. You want to learn about managing people. They've got, you know, management professors and former management professors out there doing this stuff. I mean, this is the future of learning. And I know, and I mean, I say that knowing full well that Linda's been doing exactly this for a long time, but I really feel like this is where we're all going. You know, we're all connected. You don't need to leave your house to listen to a lecture. Obviously, if you want to engage in some one-on-one with a professor, that's different. But, you know, learning stuff is, you can do a lot. And especially if you want to learn how to program or that kind of stuff, you know, it's great. You set up your iPad, you stream the Linda video there, and then you do your coding and testing. Or even, I mean, you don't even have to do that with programming. If you want to do it with QuickBooks or Photoshop, right? You know, you can watch the video on your iPad and you can have it pause or not at the end of each chapter. And I always often have it pause if I'm doing an interactive thing like that, where I want to, okay, yeah, I got it. Now let me mess around with this and touch it and play with it and let it sink in. Okay, now I'm good. And I press play and I move on to the next chapter. So these folks, they totally know what they're doing. They've been, like I said, they've been doing it for a long time, and it's great. You know, they break each course up. So even if it might be a several hour long course, you can, you know, if you've got 15 minutes, that's enough time to, you know, progress a little bit further and do it in a bite sized way. And again, you can stream this stuff to your iPhone, to your iPad. A Linda subscription starts at $25 a month. That's unlimited access to stream everything from lynda.com, lynda.com. And if you visit lynda.com/MGG, you get your first 7 days for free, no obligation, no nothing. And you could watch literally 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for those first 7 days and absorb everything you wanted. And then it's not going to be everything you wanted though. Cause if you're actually doing that, you're going to want more, cause it's just the type of person you are. And I think as a Mac Geekab listener, you're probably not going to do 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, but you're going to do a couple of courses a month. And at $25, that's short money. So check it out. Lynda.com, lynda.com/MGG. They taught me, they really helped me learn regular expressions with a course that listener Mike suggested to me. It's great stuff. They're so well done. It's great learning stuff from people that know what they're talking about. And you know that. because you listen to us here at Mac Geek Gab. So extend that when you don't have for the, you know, for the remaining hours of the week that our 90-minute show does not occupy, lynda.com/MGG will got you covered. Check it out. And thank them for us on your behalf, too. Right? Is that, did I say that right? I think so.
Right.
Right. All right, John. Take us to, are we going to, I know we've done Larry and Larry and Larry
Lewis.
And Harry, but now it's time for, I believe, Louie.
Or Louie.
Yeah. Right. Could be one or the other. I'm not sure which listener this is. We have a couple of Lewis. We have a couple of Lewis's and a couple of Louis's. This, I'm not sure which, this one might just be Lewis. I think you're right, John.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
I've configured my Airport Extreme and Ethernet connected iMac for IPv6 using your directions and the tunnelbroker.net tunnel.
Nice.
All seems to be well, and my network is working fine. I have a question regarding the 3 Airport Express base stations, 2 first gen and 1 second gen, I have around my house to extend my network. Currently, they're all set to extend a wireless network. Okay, that's good. And configure IPv6 is set to link local only. Should that be set as automatically or manually? Question mark. Should they be set to enable IPv6 connection sharing? Oh, I got a few answers here.
Yeah, so, I'm curious about this.
Well, actually, I don't think link local is the right setting. Now, how can you tell what the right setting is? Well, I'll tell you how I think I can tell.
Okay.
Because I'm extending mine. So if you go to Airport Utility, hit Edit, you'll see a number of tabs on the top here. I think the first tab you want to look at is the Internet tab. You're going to know things are working right, because what I see here, Dave, is there's an IPv6 DNS server entry, and it has something there. So I'm going to suspect that the way I am set up on this extension is correct, because I'm getting an IPv6 address for the DNS.
Okay.
Also, if you click on Internet Options in that window, you will see Configure IPv6. And I don't believe I changed this manually. I believe it just kind of set itself up the right way, and it set itself up as automatic. And
okay.
IPv6 mode is native, because the tunnel is being done by another computer, right?
Yes,
and
correct.
Enable IPv6 connection sharing I have on. Now, why do I have that on? Do I want to share? I'm going to have to look and see what that means. What does that mean?
Yeah, what does that mean?
Well, it's checked. And then it shows IPv6 default route. Okay, good. Again, so it shows it's speaking IPv6. And that's how I have that set up, at least in Internet Options.
Okay.
Look into that connection sharing. Who am I sharing with? Maybe I should turn that off. Well, not now.
Right. Yeah. Please not now. That's right.
Well, no, actually, none of the things I'm on here right now are on the extended network.
Oh, I got you. Okay. Yeah.
And then wireless, as we said, so now we're going to the wireless tab, and yeah, network mode, extended wireless network. So how it should be. And then network should say router mode off, bridge mode, if you're running as an extension. And then also in that screen, there's network options, ... And if you click on that, it's going to say block incoming IPv6 connections, and that was checked for me.
Okay.
And then allow incoming IPsec authentication. I wonder if that has to do with that connection sharing setting in the other box. It wouldn't surprise me. Two things about the same topic in different areas.
Yeah, right. Right.
But I don't recall doing any of this. It just kind of fell into place here. And it could be because this is, I think, a fourth generation Express.
No,
maybe the other ones, you got to tweak them.
Isn't there only 2 generations of Airport Express? Or am I confused?
I think you're confused.
Okay. Yeah.
No, you're right. I'm sorry. Second generation.
Okay.
How did I know that? So I clicked on the airport, and then if you click on the edit button and you hold down the option key, it will give you a summary screen. And right here it says Airport Express 802.11n second generation.
Yeah.
You're right. I'm sorry. I think my, Extreme, I think, is fourth generation. Okay.
Yeah.
That's my answer. So it sounds like, so at least in my case, the second generation just kind of got it. It set itself up properly.
So it doesn't have just a link local IPv6 address. Mm-hmm. It has a true IPv6 address that came via your tunnel. Is that a fair assessment, at least based on what you can tell here?
Well, it's getting IPv6 information, though it's in native mode. I think that answers your question.
Yeah, so it should be in native mode, right? Because your network is being serviced by the tunnel that's created by the one router. You certainly don't need to create separate tunnels. Right. Yeah. So this is interesting. And this is where Apple is further ahead on this stuff than the firmware that I use. I use those Buffalo routers, but I use the DDWRT firmware, which is available for a lot of different routers. And the IPv6 support is very, very new in these. It's been there for a while, but essentially what you had to do was turn it on and then build a whole bunch of, Unix style configuration files in order to get IPv6 working. Only very, very recently, the last, basically from when we started talking about it here, sort of the impetus for us to talk about it was that one of the developers who creates a fork of DDWRT named Kong, it started building true, single button click IPv6 support in. And it was with the help of a lot of the community. He basically took the work that the community had done and baked it in. So instead of you having to go to a website and say, copy this, and this into this spot, he just did it. And when you flip the switch, it does it. However,
Kong.
Yeah, I know. I know. He does great work. I assume it's a he. I'm 99% certain it's a he, but I'll put Kong's DDWRT page up. I'm trying to think if there's an easy way to do this. I think all I can do is link you to his repository, which I'll do. It's fine. But it's good stuff, right? It's a little geeky installing it because that's how it works. But so it works great on my main router. Like you, I don't have to set up a tunnel, but I have my main router getting the IPv6 and servicing the network. And it works great. Every client device that I have connects there. Where it gets weird is I don't think, and I've tried to ask this question, haven't really gotten an answer. I don't think there's built-in support or there's not single-click support in these routers for setting up the routers as client devices. If I enable IPv6 on one of my routers that's effectively in bridge mode, John, it goes, I think it's going out and getting its own IPv6 range from Comcast. I don't think it's joining my, one range that the main router's getting. I got to dig into that more and I got to learn how better to answer that question and then turn it on and see what's happening. But when I did it the first time, I think it was getting like I was getting it in your to equate it to your scenario. I think I was effectively getting a second tunnel. I mean, I don't have the tunnel, but I think it was just treating it that way. So I have it turned off on my bridge mode routers. It doesn't stop the clients that connect to them from getting IPv6 because the bridge mode routers just pass things through. So it works fine for all my clients, but the only router that I have that has an IPv6 address is my main one that's actually in router mode, and all the clients work fine. It's kind of frustrating from a geek level, knowing that I've got devices on the network that aren't getting IPv6 addresses, but that's true of like my Sonos devices as well. So, that's how it goes. Are we good here?
Think so.
All right. So let's see. Let's move on to Jed. Jed, I love these kinds of hacky-ish things. So Jed writes, based on your recommendations, I got a couple of Sonos units a couple of months ago, and I'm so happy. I'm actually even hearing you guys go through the new products makes me realize how good the Sonos is. Awesome. He says, however, all my music is stored on my Mac Mini. I feel bad leaving it powered on all the time, so I've been debating getting a low-cost NAS device just to store my music. I can't really justify getting the Synologies yet. Any suggestions on a simple hard drive NAS just to host my music library? I have an AirPort Extreme. Should I just hang a drive off of that? It seems so inelegant, but maybe that's the best solution. So, there is... That is a NAS solution, right? It's network attached storage at its most basic level, and it's cheap, right? You can hang a drive off your Airport Extreme. Yeah, Airport Extreme. But you could hang it off, you know, hang it off of your router in any kind of way. If your router can share it, your Sonos could connect to it. Remember, bear in mind that I believe this is still true even with the 5.1 update, Sonos will only connect using SMB, not AFP, to your music library. But since all Apple devices support SMB, and in fact, it's the preferred way in Mavericks, that's okay. So yes, this would totally work. And it is, you know, quote unquote, a poor man's NAS, probably the wrong term, but I think it sends the right, checks the right box. It's an inexpensive NAS. However, Synology, you say that, you know, that you can't justify paying the money for a Synology. And that may well be true for the, you know, the super hoopty stuff, like, you know, like the S15 13 plus that I like to use, or even the 412. I mean, you're in the, you know, $400 to $600 range for just the bare metal, and then you've got to put drives in it. It does a lot of great stuff, but you know, if all you're looking to do is share your music, that's sort of hard to justify. However, you know, the two drive DS214 SE, which you can get for about $170 empty, that's not a bad place to start. Because you're in the Synology world. It runs a full version of DSM, Synology's Disk Station Manager. It's not beefy enough to stream, to transcode video and stream it. But if you've got video that you know, is of the format that, say, your Apple TV can receive, Video Station will likely be able to stream that for you. But even without that, it'll do lots. And the best part is, if you decide down the road that you really love Synology and want to upgrade to a bigger, better, faster unit, you take your drives out, put them in the new one, and all your data goes with you. And now you're used to DSM and you know how that works. But if your only goal is to share iTunes, and yeah, hanging it off of an Airport Extreme is a totally fine and valid option. And there's no reason not to consider that, but you can get yourself into the, you know, the Synology world for pretty darn cheap if you want to head down that path. And John, actually, you found something this week that's even cheaper, right?
I was amazed. Yes. So I got an email from Synology saying, hey, we got something new.
Yeah.
The DS115J. And I think it's so new that I can't find any shops that are selling it yet. But okay, I did find a review, because I'm wondering, well, how much is it?
Right.
You know, so it's a single bay, looks pretty basic, though not basic as in wimpy. And that it seems, I'm not entirely clear on the how much of the video heavy lifting it can do here.
I think it's probably the same as the 214 SE, that it'll stream. I read a little bit when you mentioned it pre-show. I believe it will let Video Station, which is Synology's video streaming app, which is awesome, by the way. It's pretty much replaced Plex for us here in the Hamilton household, both for streaming to our TV as well as syncing to our iOS devices. But I think, again, it'll stream a file as long as it doesn't have to do any transcoding of that file. So if the file is in a format that your Apple TV can understand natively, or your device, then you're good to go. So yeah, it's I think you've got the OneDrive version of a Synology. You get no fault tolerance. If the drive goes bad, you're done. But I think, what did you find the price on that to be, the MSRP, or
one article? Well, ahead in both euros and US dollars, okay. But it looks to be about $120.
Yeah. See, that's a nice little way to, and that's empty, right? You got to put your own drive in or buy a drive. But
as far as I can tell,
yeah. But you know, so for $200, you've got a NAS unit that can do a lot of stuff. It can even run your CalDAV server, like we were mentioning. It's full DSM in these things. So that's where it gets really interesting is, you know, you get the benefits of this software that's built for NAS, you know, arrays of, you know, 16 drives and whatever. And it just works in these smaller units, which is very, very cool. So you could run BitTorrent sync on it. You know, you can run all kinds of stuff, which is cool. And I think that one, they said, has what, 256 megs of RAM. It's not a ton, but it'll get a lot of it done. Right?
I would hope so.
That's what we hope. We all hope. Hope, that's the beauty of hope, right? Is
Well, they got a nice comparison in the link. Okay. They compare the performance to other low end ones here. So I see the 112 Plus, the 114, the 115J, and the 112J. So they help you understand where it fits in the their ecosystem.
Yeah. Huh. Awesome. All right. So that scratches Jed off the list. Where are we on time here? I think we've got time for a couple of quick tips, John. This is another one of these. So we talked about Mark in MacGeekab 516, where he wanted to have his NAS device accessible to all of his local computers, but was not comfortable letting his NAS device be accessible to or from the internet. And we came up with a couple of solutions, but listener John offered yet another interesting solution. This would work for any device that you don't want, that you want accessible on your local network, but don't want or need to have internet access. And he says, assuming the device supports static IP addressing, spoof or change the gateway value. Simply do not assign the actual gateway IP address to the device. By using a non-valid gateway address, the device will not be able to send or receive traffic to or from anywhere but the local network. So he says Mark could try to leave the gateway field blank on his Synology, but lots of devices require some assigned value in that field. The value can assign to the gateway address can be anything. It can even be another device already on the network. The way that works is when you're setting up an IPv4 device, I'm trying to think of how this would work with IPv6, John, but it might be, I don't know. You might want to turn off IPv6 at this point, because IPv6 isn't going to do you any good on your local network anyway, in that sense. So turn off IPv6 just to limit confusion, and then set a static IP address for your IPv4, your quote unquote normal IP for the device. And then when you set up IPv4 addresses, if you're doing them manually, you have to set up the gateway, which is typically the address of your router. And what that does is it tells the, in this case, the Synology, if I'm not connecting to something on the local network, I have to ask the gateway to help me get out to the internet. I think that's a fairly correct description of that. Right, John, would you agree?
Sure.
Okay. All right. I mean, you know, you put in that this is the gateway we're going to use to get out of our local network. And if that gateway will not respond, then you can't get out of the local network, but you can still connect to everything in the local network. So if your gateway address is, say, 192.168.1.1, if you set your Synology to the gateway of 192.168.1.2, then it's not going to be able to get out, because unless you have a second gateway at .1.2. Which you might if you're crazy and you have multiple internet connections servicing your local network, which is totally possible, but you probably don't. But if you do, then set it to .3 or .100 or, you know, something in that realm, and that should solve that problem. I like it. It's a good hack, John. Don't you think, John?
Yeah, it makes me uneasy.
Does it?
Well, you're not supposed to do it that way.
Well, I know. But that's the beauty of it, is you just tell it, done, good to go. You could also program your router to not let that device communicate on the internet, right? I mean, like, I don't know that you can do this with an Apple router, but with mine, I can set up, you know, a parental controls window where certain devices are not allowed to communicate on the internet between certain hours and, you know, things like that, right? You can set up all that stuff. So I could just set, okay, this device, never allow it to communicate on the internet, and then that would do it too.
Yeah. Oh yeah, they got that. They got a.
They do, right?
Internet network. Enable. So in the network tab in the airport utility, enable access control, and you have timed access control, and you can control it by IP address and all that. So as long as the person trying to, you know, get out isn't smart enough to change their IP on
right.
their own.
Right. Yeah, well, that's, and hopefully your Synology is not smart enough to change its IP, because if it is, then, you know, it's time for Skynet, and we're We're heading down the wrong path.
Right.
Yes. Right. Right. Did I get that reference right? I think I did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The machines are going to be self-aware.
That's right. Yeah. I feel like that might not be a bad thing. No, that would, that might be.
I think it'd be terrible.
It'd be terrible.
Yeah. They'll decide that we're unnecessary.
That's the thing. Right.
That's how it always ends up.
It is.
When the machines get smart, they get too smart.
It's too smart. Yeah. All right. A quick one from Eric before we wrap things up today, John. He writes, you know, we were talking about buying a refurb Apple TV for $75, which you can still get. But he says, if you spend the $99 on an Apple TV from Apple, you get a free 25, well, not free, included with that $99, you get an Apple TV and a $25 iTunes Store gift card. So if you are going to be buying movies and renting movies and want to head down that path, then you can go that route and add $25 to your iTunes account. So that's a great find. So either way, you're buying refurb or new, you're getting a full $100 or you're getting, you know, $75 value for the Apple TV, assuming you're going to use that $25 gift card on the other one. So thanks for pointing that out. That's good stuff. We're always looking for good deals like that. And with that, John, I believe it's time. It must be. The show's over. Well, not quite over yet. So, hey, we've got a couple more days before we do the cutoff on the premium gifts that we're going to send out. And I've seen some of you topping up your accounts to make sure. We said it was going to be the 10th. Realistically, it's probably going to be the 11th. So, well, you've got through the 10th because I'm flying out and, you know, it's going to be crazy. I'm actually not flying back until the 10th. So I'll be out in California on the 9th. And then we'll put together the list and we'll confirm your addresses with you and all that stuff that we have done for you in the past. And then we'll send out the mugs. So if you want to learn more about Mac Geek Gab Premium, you can go to MacGeekGab.com/premium and that will get you there. And we certainly appreciate your support and are happy to do these gifts each year to ensure that that's just our way of saying thanks is what that is. So go ahead and okay, we're here. You know, I keep having Time Machine backup start that keeps screwing up the audio because that's like the one thing that likes to chew up CPU and disk and all that. And
maybe you should change the scheduling of that.
I did, dude. And then no, I just noticed
you didn't do it right.
I clearly didn't do it right because I just noticed that it was on in the Time Machine settings, which it should not be if I'm using Time Machine Editor. It's wrong. I totally screwed it up. I apologize for that. So yeah, check it out. MacGeekGab.com/premium. If you're interested and able, we certainly appreciate it and are looking forward to sending out the thank you gifts to those of you that have contributed up to or more than $100 since the last gift. So, all right. And if you are a premium member, you can email us at premium@macgeekgab.com, and that is reserved just for you. But if you're not a premium member, that's okay too. We totally get it. And that's why we have feedback@macgeekgab.com, and we do attempt to answer everything that comes in to both addresses, and this week again we succeeded, so that is our goal. But the premium stuff definitely gets the nod first because that's how it works.
feedback@macgeekgab.com, that's what he said.
And feedback@macgeekgab.com is what he said. What's the phone number, John?
206-666-GEEK,
which is 4335 on your telephone device there. It's good.
On your touchtone pad.
That's right. That's right.
Or pulse if you're into that sort of thing.
Yeah, you could pulse dial that if you so chose.
Really?
Why not? I mean, if you have a phone that does that still. I don't know if your phone system would support it. I think a while back they started doing it where if you pulse dial, it actually converts it to the multi-frequency tones, right? Gosh. I don't know. Anyway, tell them about Twitter, John.
Twitter.com. Everybody's there. And if you're on there, I'm John O'Brien. He's Dave Hamilton. The other guy's Pilot Pete. The podcast is Mac Geek Gab, and the publication is Mac Observer, all on Twitter.com.
We'd like to thank Michael Johnston, who's also on Twitter.com at Michael Johnston. He is the host of the iOS Show podcast, which is a killer show. I highly recommend you listen to it. He also is the one that converts this show to AAC and adds the chapters. So thank you so much, Michael. Yeah, but folks, go listen to that show. He does a great job with it. It's awesome stuff. And of course, I want to thank the folks at Cachefly, CacheFly.com. They provide all the bandwidth to get the show from us to you. I want to thank the folks in our podcast marketplace. Of course, that includes Harry's with the coupon code MGG, Lynda, LYNDA.com/MGG for 7 days free there, barebones.com, smile at smilesoftware.com, Gazelle to sell your old iOS stuff, get that in, squarespace.com with the coupon code MGG, but also visit squarespace.com/MGG. And of course, the folks at Drobo, also the makers of the Transporter, awesome stuff there. So check that out too at drobo.com. John, lasting advice?
No. Well, okay. Don't get caught.
Made up.